Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 29, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum on the ongoing greenhouse gas litigation in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Note from the outset, please, that this is ongoing litigation, and as such, our experts, two of whom are involved in the litigation, will be somewhat limited in what they can say. I think they'll probably be focusing primarily on what has happened so far and less on strategies going forward. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please also note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. And also, this call is being recorded so we can post it as a podcast in the future on our website. Today, we're pleased to welcome three experts to our call. Our moderator, Marlo Lewis Jr., is one of our experts, and momentarily he'll introduce to you the other two. Mr. Lewis himself is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, where he writes on global warming, energy policy, and other public policy issues. Prior to joining CEI in April 2002, he served as Director of External Relations at the Reason Foundation in Los Angeles. He's also held positions in government and the private sector. And with that, Mr. Lewis, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and welcome everybody to this teleforum. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce our two panelists, Sean Donahue, who for the last 7 years has had a small appellate firm with a non-exclusive focus on environmental work. And he has represented the Environmental Defense Fund in many cases, including in Coalition for Responsible Regulation versus EPA. He was previously a visiting professor at Washington and Lee School of Law. And before that, he worked at the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division, overlapping with our other panelist, Mr. Jeff Clark, who is a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. He's been with the firm since 1996, with the exception of his period of service with the Department of Justice from 2001 to 2005. Jeff worked on several cutting-edge cases in several areas of law and argued and won the noted Massachusetts versus EPA case in the D.C. Circuit. And I have been involved in this particular issue, EPA regulation of greenhouse gases, for some time. I was a staff director to former Congressman David McIntosh, whose subcommittee of the Government Oversight and Reform Committee held the first hearing ever on EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. That was back in October 1999. It was also in October 1999 when the International Center for Technology Assessment and numerous other environmental and renewable energy organizations petitioned EPA to regulate greenhouse gases from new motor vehicles. And the Clinton administration did not take action on the petition, although the general counsel for the EPA at the time, Jonathan Cannon, wrote a memorandum the year before in April of 1998 stating that several regulatory provisions of the Clean Air Act were potentially applicable to greenhouse gases. The Bush administration, EPA, decided to take public comment on the petition and decided that in 2003 that it didn't have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and even if it did, for prudential reasons, policy reasons, it would decline to do so. That decision was appealed. It went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where Jeff played a key role. That decision was appealed to the Supreme Court, and in the Supreme Court case of Massachusetts versus EPA, and pardon me, please, if this is all well-trodden territory for many of you, but just in case some folks don't remember all of the background, The Supreme Court in 2007 ruled that greenhouse gases are air pollutants for regulatory purposes under the Clean Air Act, that EPA had to determine whether greenhouse gas emissions from new motor vehicles endanger public health and welfare unless the agency provided statutory reasons why it could not or would not undertake such an analysis, and finally, that the agency must set greenhouse gas emission standards if it determines that such emissions endanger public health or welfare. And the rest, as they say, is history. The EPA issued its endangerment rule in December 2009 that compelled the agency to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from new motor vehicles. And then in May of 2010, the agency issued its greenhouse gas tailpipe rule. The EPA has long held that once any pollutant, any air pollutant from any source is regulated under any part of the Clean Air Act, then major stationary sources of the pollutant become subject to regulation under the Act's Title I Prevention of Significant Deterioration Pre-Construction Permitting Program and the Title V Operating Permits Program. EPA reaffirmed that interpretation in April 2010 in its triggering or timing rule. Now, the problem was that those rules threatened to create a politically explosive administrative quagmire. According to EPA's own estimates, literally millions of non-industrial facilities emit enough carbon dioxide, the chief industrial greenhouse gas, to qualify as major sources under PSD and Title V. And EPA said that if it had to apply the PSD and Title V permitting requirements according to the statutory definitions of major source, it and state permitting agencies would have to process an estimated 81,000 PSD permits annually instead of about 280, and 6.1 million Title V permits annually instead of about 15,000. To handle this workload, EPA estimated, agencies would have to hire an additional 320,000 full-time employees at a cost of $21 billion a year. Otherwise, growing bottlenecks and delays would paralyze environmental enforcement and economic development alike. Then, to avoid these absurd results, absurd because they contravene congressional purposes, the EPA in July 2010 issued a tailoring rule exempting small carbon dioxide emitters from the permitting programs. And so instead of the threshold for being regulated as major being 100 tons in a year in the case of Title V or 250 tons in the case of PSD, the cutoff was now 100,000 tons. And this, of course, raised eyebrows, because even though agencies should have some interpretive discretion when statutory language is ambiguous, there is nothing unclear about 100 tons or 250 tons, and those numbers were manifestly not drafting errors. So tailoring, I think one could argue, and here I'm editorializing a bit, but you'll just have to take that. Tailoring is bureau speak for amending. So in 2011, a coalition of industry groups, states, and nonprofits petitioned the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn all four of these rules. And that was the case of Coalition for Responsible Regulation versus EPA. The court in June of last year upheld all four of EPA's greenhouse gas regulations. The court ruled that EPA unambiguously interpreted the statute correctly. In August, the coalition members petitioned for an en banc rehearing of the case. On December 20th, the court voted 5-2 to deny the petitions. However, given the importance of the case and what I consider the strong dissenting opinions by Judges Janice Rogers Brown and Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court may review the case. And conceivably, the Supreme Court could also reassess part of its ruling or all of its ruling in Massachusetts versus EPA. Now, we're still in the early phases of the EPA's career as a greenhouse gas regulator. In June, the agency proposed greenhouse gas new source performance standards for fossil fuel electric generating units. Somewhere in the pipeline are new source performance standards for petroleum refineries, and after that, other industrial source categories. The EPA has committed itself to propose greenhouse gas performance guidelines for existing, that is to say, non-modified fossil fuel electric generating units. And petitions have been pending at the EPA since the Bush administration to establish greenhouse gas emission standards for marine vessels, aircraft, and non-road engines. And at some point, I think, the EPA will have to address the four-year-old petition from the Center for Biological Diversity and 350.org to establish national ambient air quality standards for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And I would just say that what this means is that the EPA is on course, really, to establishing a comprehensive greenhouse gas regulatory program for the entire U.S. economy. And some of us, myself included, scratch our heads as to when Congress ever actually delegated such immense authority to the agency, which I think is one reason why there has been so much litigation over this. And also why there have been several attempts in Congress to roll back some of these regulations. Anyway, I'm very eager, and I'm sure you are all as well, to hear from our panelists. And I'm sure you all have many questions. I suppose that the most relevant question to ask of the panelists is whether they think the court was correct in holding that the EPA that the EPA's reading of the PSD provision was unambiguously correct, and I'm sure that I'll have other questions to ask as we proceed, but I don't want to preempt any of yours. So with that, I will turn over the proceedings to Jeff Clark, who has agreed to go first.
Well, Marlo, thank you very much for those comprehensive introductory remarks. I think you've really set the stage very well. In particular, actually, by asking the question of what our views are as to the correctness of the decisions by the D.C. Circuit, that's exactly what I'd like to talk about. And if I could, I'd like to cover four points, and those are first to focus on how the court dealt with the challenge to the endangerment rule, the legal challenge to the endangerment rule. Second, to talk about how EPA misconstrued Massachusetts versus EPA, I think an error that carried over from EPA to the D.C. Circuit panel. Third, the important implications of this litigation for the separation of powers and the proper construction of statutes. In particular, the issue of the separation of powers, import of these cases, was really explained nicely by Judge Kavanaugh in his dissent. But I'll also talk a little bit about Judge Brown's dissent. And then lastly, what the implications are for this case, for the national economy and why it really is an exceptionally important piece of litigation. So turning to the first point, in focusing on the endangerment rule, that's really the first domino that kicks off all of the rulemakings, and I think Marlo has described that well, that basically if an endangerment finding is made, that it creates first a mandatory duty to issue regulation of new motor vehicle greenhouse gas emissions, and then on EPA's argument at least, it also then creates the mandatory need to regulate greenhouse gases from stationary sources, which vastly expands the scope of the existing programs under the Act and really becomes the springboard to all of the other, follow-on greenhouse gas regulations of the national economy that Marlo was describing. It is my view that the endangerment rule is really flawed from its conception, from its inception. It failed to deal with the absurdity that EPA admitted. As Marlo was describing it, in the very rulemakings at issue, EPA says very clearly that they think all of the sources that they would need to regulate under the PSD program, the stationary source program at issue, that if they were required to regulate that under the 250 ton per year limit, so many sources would be regulated that it would be, in their view, absurd. And that issue of the absurd consequences of the regulation by EPA's own admission, the contention in the litigation was that that's a factor that needed to be analyzed at the very start when the first domino was tipped over as to regulation. And the EPA refused to consider that. It said the issue of the consequences of its regulation, pursuant to the endangerment rule, were not the subject of whether it could issue an endangerment rule or not, which I think is quite an astonishing proposition. Most of you who are lawyers on the call will recognize that agencies have, and everyone really has, an obligation if they're construing a statute to construe it as a whole, not to look at it on a kind of piecemealed, stovepiped basis, which is the essence of EPA's reasoning about the statute. And then to compound that error, the panel accepted EPA's rationale and said only about that argument that absurdity needed to be considered from the very inception of the rules was something that it was an absurdity that was seen by the petitioners. In other words, it was the petitioners who were trying to establish that there were absurd consequences rather than the agency from the very start of the rules admitting that they would lead to absurd consequences and then reaching the issue of whether the agency needed to look at that issue before it launched the rules, before it launched the first one, the endangerment finding. And it was also the contention in the litigation that EPA couldn't put off the analysis until the very end at the tailoring rule stage and then turn to rewriting the statute. There it becomes even more astonishing that EPA rewrote statutory numerical thresholds by orders of magnitude, taking them from 250 tons per year up to 75,000 tons per year, all so that it could regulate fewer sources. And from there, let me turn to my second point, which is how the agency misconstrued and how the panel agreed with that, the Supreme Court Massachusetts versus EPA decision. The agency read the case essentially to compel issuance of an endangerment finding, but the Supreme Court opinion really says no such thing. Instead, it entered in response to the rulemaking petition that was filed by the International Center for Technology Assessment merely a remand, and the court said the following. Here are probably two of – there are several passages that are relevant, but here are the most important two. But once EPA has responded to a petition for rulemaking, its reasons for action or inaction must conform to the authorizing statute. So EPA, as we read Massachusetts versus EPA, would seem to be required to look at any arguments at any stage of any rulemaking as to whether it would be proper to regulate greenhouse gases or not, and to consider the absurdity that it would unleash beyond Congress's intention if it did so. The second passage is that the court also said that we need not and do not reach the question of whether on remand EPA must make an endangerment finding or whether policy concerns can inform EPA's actions in the event it makes such a finding. So the whole notion of reading Massachusetts versus EPA to compel issuing an endangerment finding, we think is all wet. The third point is the implications that this has for the separation of powers, because functionally what EPA did was to read the whole regime, and in particular its use of the absurdity canon, to allow it to rewrite numerical thresholds that Congress fixed in the law. Agencies clearly have Chevron authority to read ambiguous provisions if they are ambiguous and to put, as it were, their policy stamp on it, or the stamp of the president in question who's in charge. But numbers aren't ambiguous. And so by using this sort of set of rulemakings and the way they put them together and their use of the absurdity canon, EPA just entirely rewrote the numbers in the statute. And that, poses very clear and profound separation of powers questions. It also brings up very serious questions of the proper interpretation of statutes, the proper use of the absurdity canon, and the like. And Judge Kavanaugh recognized those very clearly in his dissent. I think that dissent is getting a lot of attention in professional circles and even in broader circles, because it's fairly easy to see what the problem is there. And then the last point I have is really what the implications are of this EPA power grab, as it were. Massachusetts versus EPA stated, and so this was an assumption on which the case was based, that EPA's jurisdiction would lead to not lead to extreme measures. EPA would only regulate emissions, and even then, it would have to delay any action to permit the development and application of the requisite technology, and this is for vehicles, giving appropriate consideration to the costs of compliance. But here, EPA actually did not do a cost-benefit analysis for its greenhouse gas regulation of stationary sources, and it refused to do so. And the Supreme Court, at no point in the Massachusetts versus EPA decision, was ever told that stationary source regulation would automatically ensue at levels that Congress never intended. And it especially wasn't told that that would happen without any analysis of the costs and implications for the national economy. Instead, what it was told by the petitioners in the Massachusetts versus EPA case is that the Title I stationary source program and the Title II regulation of motor vehicles programs were entirely separate, and that all the rulemaking petitions were asking for in Massachusetts versus EPA was to regulate cars. So what we have is that a large number of costs in terms of number of sources and a great magnitude of costs are imposed on the national economy at probably about the worst time imaginable, all to achieve which by EPA's own estimations is avoiding a centimeter of sea level rise over a 90-year span of time, and all while essentially the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles can already occur based on the regulatory authority that wasn't challenged of a separate agency. For those kinds
Jeff,
of reasons,
Jeff, let me just tell you, you're already over a minute beyond 8 minutes, so try to wrap up, please.
Yes, I was actually at my very last sentence, but thank you.
Okay, I apologize for interrupting.
That's okay. No, so my last sentence is that those implications for the national economy are precisely, and those absurd kinds of consequences are exactly why Judge Brown, in her separate dissent, called for a reexamination potentially by the Supreme Court of whether the Massachusetts versus EPA decision was rightly decided, in part because it might have been decided based on a wrong set of assumptions. And so that's it, Marlo, and happy to hear from Sean.
Thanks, Jeff. Sean Donahue, I represent Environmental Defense Fund, which is one of the environmental groups that intervened in support of EPA and these various lawsuits challenging the rulemakings that Marlo has described, along with NRDC and others, and then quite a number of states and local governments that supported EPA. I see things quite differently on virtually all these points. I mean, I think at the center of all this is the actual physical problem that we're talking about, which is climate change driven by human activity, particularly burning fossil fuels, which is posing an imminent and severe threat to human society, ecosystems, et cetera. That problem has driven EPA to begin to use the various tools in the Clean Air Act to try to address the emissions that are threatening us. The Clean Air Act, I would readily concede, is not the optimal or the only tool for addressing greenhouse gas emissions, but it is applicable by its terms to air pollution. This is an air pollution problem. The law enacted in 1970 and amended in 1977 and 1990 applies here. We can't wish it away, and so some of these difficulties of implementation are just the sort of what would be expected as our society begins using our national legal apparatus to contend with a very grave problem. I would love to see a comprehensive, targeted greenhouse gas regulation. I think it would look differently than the Clean Air Act looks in many respects, Until we have that, I think we should use the tools that we have, and indeed, in some cases, EPA must use those tools given the way the law is written. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. I'll talk just a little bit about how I see the coalition case. I agree it's very important. The court had before it more climate science than probably any of the various pieces of greenhouse gas litigation that have come to the court so far, and it's I think quite properly deferred to EPA's judgment that the overwhelming scientific record showed that the statutory standard of endangerment was satisfied. We haven't talked much about the vehicle regulations or the tailpipe rule, which is actually supported in this case by vehicle manufacturers. It will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 1 billion metric tons for the vintages of automobiles covered by it. It's probably the single most important part of this in terms of emissions reductions. And it's supported by industry. There was no challenge to, the technical feasibility or cost or otherwise. And in fact, the auto manufacturers were in telling the court, please don't vacate this rule. The tailoring rule is obviously the most gets the most attention. And there is a good example of EPA struggling with a way in which the Clean Air Act, not easily the machinery of the Clean Air Act, has to be fitted to this new air pollution problem. The claims that this case is this enormously costly and burdensome one for the U.S. economy are, to some extent, have to be taken with a grain of salt. I mean, EPA has, in implementing the tailoring rule, which is not a permanent exemption or amendment of the statute, but is a means of making sure that the immediate implication application of the stationary source program to greenhouse gas sources doesn't have unadministrable results, and in the first phase, EPA found that only a few dozen sources were having to get stationary source permits because of their greenhouse gas emissions. So that at least with the tailoring rule, the impact is very modest, and so you have this strange situation of environmental groups and others who might otherwise be expected to oppose a rule that has the effect of relaxing regulation, at least temporarily, supporting that rule, and you have industry saying, please, please get rid of these deregulatory rules so that we can show that this entire enterprise is impossible. It raises an interesting standing question that the D.C. Circuit thought was an easy standing question, that parties who are benefited by a rule can't challenge it. I'll briefly mention there's a number of other pieces of litigation that are sort of in the hopper waiting for the final resolution of these. Some of them relate to the rules that EPA adopted to assist states' implementation of the stationary source rules, those have been challenged on sort of Clean Air Act, cooperative federalism, and statutory grounds. Those challenges have been briefed, but the court hasn't set an argument date, and perhaps it's waiting for final resolution of the main body of cases that Marlowe described. And then there's a series of challenges to additional steps that the agency has taken. The tailoring, the step three of the tailoring rule, EPA has finalized a couple of additional rules regulating motor vehicles, imposing greenhouse gas emission standards that have been challenged. But I think it's fair to say all those challenges are sort of derivative of these main ones and will probably stand or fall with the resolution of these cases. I guess another point I'd make is that the challenges that were levied against this set of EPA rules would have, if sustained, would have very different circumstances. I mean, Jeff described challenges to the endangerment rule, which because it is the basis for the vehicle regulations, if that were set aside, that would have very broad implications and would sort of potentially put a halt to this whole series of regulations that we're talking about. I think given the strength of the climate science and the statutory standard, that is extremely unlikely, and given the deference that courts owe agency assessment of scientific and technical information, I think that the record is pretty overwhelming. Then some of the other challenges would have different implications. There are arguments that EPA could sort of excise the stationary source program so that it could still regulate motor vehicles, but it couldn't apply the prevention of significant deterioration program to greenhouse gas sources. And then there's still somewhat narrower arguments that were advanced very aggressively by some of the petitioners, and as I read it, to have been advanced by Judge Kavanaugh, that EPA can and should and must excise greenhouse gases from the PSD program, but emissions of greenhouse gases would still be covered by that program for sources that are otherwise subject to the program. That's the language that says any pollutant subject to regulation under this act, which Judge Kavanaugh says, oh, that's that does include greenhouse gases. And there are a number of other challenges, so that they're pretty important differences. This is not a case where there's kind of one legal attack with clear consequences. There are a lot of different levels of potential risk to the EPA program, depending on which of these challenges were sustained, if a court were to sustain one. I'll just briefly mention, I noted that there are a number of states, including California and New York and Massachusetts and others, that intervened in support of EPA. There are also states that were petitioners and very active petitioners in the case. As a sort of general observation about this case, and it's not unique to greenhouse gases, but it's a case where sort of conceptions of federalism are, it sort of reminds us that we can have different, including diametrically opposed ideas of what federalism means or should mean in a particular context. I mean, I think the general position of the states supporting EPA is, we think this problem is a grave risk to our people, our land, our coastline, et cetera. We are doing some things to try to address it, but we can't effectively address it without federal action. Help us, and once you've taken some steps, we're going to support you. On the other hand, the petitioner states think, we don't agree that this is necessary. We think that the rules here are a grave imposition, a diktat, et cetera. This is the federal government stepping on us. There's a little bit, I'm sure many listeners are also followed the cross-state air pollution rule case, in which the court, on an opinion by Judge Kavanaugh, went against EPA, had the same kind of dynamic of lots of states on both sides with sort of making federalism arguments, but from different directions.
Sean, try to wrap up quickly.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I will wrap up and say I look forward to questions, and thanks a lot for having me today.
Okay, great. All right. Well, as I'll invoke my moderator privilege to just raise one question that the two panelists may wish to address, and that is the separation of powers issue, which Jeff mentioned. Jeff mentioned it primarily in the context of the tailoring rule, which he views as an exercise of statutory revision by an administrative agency. Sean does not. I think that there's an even larger separation of powers issue here, which is, consider it this way, that for about 20 years we have had advocacy for greenhouse gas regulatory legislation. The Congress never actually got around to passing a greenhouse gas regulatory bill. The closest was Waxman-Markey, which passed the House. But one of Waxman-Markey's chief selling points was that it would preempt EPA regulation of greenhouse gases under several, although not all, Clean Air Act authorities. And even then, the companion legislation died in the Senate. If you just look at the whole history of this discussion since the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, attempts have been made to amend the Clean Air Act so to make it address greenhouse gases. Those failed in the 1990 amendments. And so, what Massachusetts versus EPA has done, really, is given EPA a degree of authority over greenhouse gases that repeated attempts legislatively have failed to do. And in fact, if Waxman and Markey, for example, had introduced a bill that said, this bill authorizes EPA to do exactly what it's doing now, which is regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act according to its best judgment, that bill not only would not have passed the House, it would have been dead on arrival. What Massachusetts versus EPA implies is that somehow back in 1970, before global warming ever became a public policy concern, Congress gave this very expansive authority to the EPA. Now, we don't have time to argue over the text of the Clean Air Act, but I do think this raises a very obvious separation of powers issue. Today we have an agency that is effectively legislating climate policy for mobile sources, stationary sources, and it is just at the start of its regulatory career here, and that is really more, it seems to me that is beyond any administrative agency's pay grade, what it is doing now. It is acting as a super legislature. And I wonder if you two would address this issue.
Well, this is Jeff Clark. Let me say, Marlo, that I agree with that. I think you well stated the case for why, this is a serious issue that, to see repeated attempts, fail in the Congress to grant EPA authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. I'd also add to that the dynamic under which these rules were issued was directly tied to that. Functionally, the EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, was telling Congress in letters and other exchanges that if Congress did not pass Waxman-Markey, which was up before Congress at the time, then she was going to kick over the first domino with the endangerment finding. And so sure enough, that's exactly what happened. That kind of game of chicken with Congress, I think, is a serious concern. It was, it obviously attracted a lot of attention at the time it was going on. But separation of powers concerns are really all over these cases. They're present in the issue of the tailoring rule that I talked about. They're present in the issue you raised at a kind of macro level, Marlo. They're also present in the issue of standing, because standing is very closely tied to separation of powers concerns. And there, just as a kind of quick, mini rebuttal to Sean, the idea that these rules are beneficial or deregulatory when essentially they're the first time that greenhouse gases have ever been regulated and, by EPA under the Clean Air Act, and they were part of a package that was deliberately designed and very carefully put together and rolled out over a series of months, that the rules somehow benefit industry who's now being, you know, subject to this regulation for the first time ever, and yet they lack standing, is also something that I think is a very questionable ruling and one that the Supreme Court might be interested in checking.
Well, Sean.
I would say, first of all, I mean, the court let the industry petitioners test, and it rejected on the merits the argument that greenhouse gases, that stationary source regulation of greenhouse gases follows from the 202 endangerment finding, right? So that issue was so what industry couldn't challenge is whether EPA had the authority to administratively alter the thresholds under the tailoring rule. So it wasn't like the question of statutory applicability wasn't resolved. I mean, separation of powers, I think part of it is that Congress enacts laws and courts are bound to follow the laws that are enacted in accordance with their terms. And, you know, that is, you know, that certainly the D.C. Circuit panel understood that principle and you know, adhered to it. They reached the conclusion, which we think is right, that the act unambiguously does apply, and that this is, you know, I know Judge Kavanaugh's statement on the rehearing petitions takes issue with us, but I think the panel has it right as a matter of construing the statute that any air pollutant, is a broad term, and that there isn't an available and reasonable way of reading that to not include greenhouse gases. So, I think it is, and I also disagree about the sort of legislative history. I think, as I said at the beginning, and I think every major environmental group and the states who are supporting this all agree that having a legislative program specifically designed to deal with greenhouse gases would be far preferable. But that's different. Those fights were about whether to enact that kind of program. An economy-wide cap-and-trade program or the other variants, they don't, I think, cast doubt on the decision in Massachusetts versus EPA that greenhouse gases are an air pollutant and that the existing machinery that we have does apply to this problem, even though many of us would like to see a better program enacted. I think the default is not no applicability at all of our comprehensive air pollution statute to this gravest of air pollution problems. So I just would read that history quite differently.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. For my humble opinion about the Supreme Court's reading of the pertinent provision, which was the definition of air pollutant, if anybody is interested, I wrote a piece for Engage, the Federalist Society Journal, in November of 2011. It's called EPA Regulation of Fuel Economy, Congressional Intent, or Climate Coup. And you'll see that I don't think the court read that provision correctly, but who am I? I'm not even a lawyer. Now let's take questions from all of you folks who have called in. And please try to keep your questions concise and make them questions. Obviously, you may need to do a little explaining before you ask the question, but please make this a question, something that ends with a question mark rather than just a platform for making a speech.
Very good. Thank you, Marla Lewis. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, everybody should hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting for those folks to ring in, let me announce that later this week on Thursday, we're going to host another Teleforum conference call at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. and then we'll be discussing class action litigation against food manufacturers, what some of the latest trends are with the FTC, the Department of Agriculture, the FDA, and state AGs in class action litigation against food manufacturers. And Marlo, it looks like right now we have three callers with questions. We'll go to the first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Leaving aside the way in which this kind of regulation trashes the constitutional principles of non-delegation and enumerated powers, has there been any serious examination of the problem that the territorial jurisdiction of the EPA is confined to the United States, and by a fairly reasonable analysis, the suppression of emissions under this regime within the United States will most likely cause the emissions to increase outside of its territorial jurisdiction, perhaps by a factor of 2 to 10 times. So that it becomes merely a futile gesture that might feel good, but in fact will make the situation worse on balance.
Do either of the panelists want to address that?
Quickly, the argument that there were, you know, foreign policy implications, as it were, because this is a global problem, was put, you know, as a reason not to regulate by the Bush EPA to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. It has not surfaced, you know, very much in the remand litigation, but the argument was made that, you know, this is a situation where the rulemaking at issue would lead to such a minor impact in terms of EPA's own analysis on temperature, and an impact that could have been accomplished equally well by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's fuel economy regulations, that EPA hadn't adequately explained why it needed to launch this, you know, vast set of interlocking rules in order to get to the same place, you know, and to the, you know, the problem it was trying to solve. But it hasn't been a focus of the remand litigation, is the short answer.
I would just add, you know, leakage, the questioner referred to the concept that if you try to control emissions in one place, it might have the effect, the perverse effect of encouraging emissions elsewhere, annulling or even, you know, exacerbating the annulling the benefit or making the problem worse. I mean, I think in the case of the major step here, which is motor vehicles, that's the big emissions reductions. The stationary source provisions here apply only to new sources or modified sources. The amount of emissions is relatively modest compared to the vehicle rule. I don't think the argument can be sustained that by driving much cleaner cars here, we are there may be some effect, but very little. I think this is mainly a gain in terms of reducing emissions. So,
but has there actually been an analysis?
I know that it's something that EPA does not view this program as the one where you have to conduct or can conduct a programmatic, it's not like a cap and trade program where the agency is setting a level from the beginning. The economic analysis that occurs under the PSD program is at the level of the particular permitted facility. But I know that state programs do look at leakage. The ones who are enacting, like California's cap and trade program, that is something that every regulator is going to look at.
Okay, let's go to the next question, please.
Hi, this is Mario Loyola, Texas Public Policy Foundation. Thanks for taking my call. I have just a quick question at the outset. And then maybe a bit of a longer one, and I might have missed this at the very beginning of the call, but I just wanted to get a little better clarity on what the time horizon is here, what a time horizon would be for the Supreme Court taking up the D.C. Circuit decision now that the rehearing has been refused. So that's one quick question. The second one, I just wanted to address a little bit the issue of standing on the tailoring rule. And I'd like to just ask if Sean is at all concerned with, if let's just say as a hypothetical, and I don't want this to be an absurd hypothetical, but let's just say as a hypothetical that EPA says we are hereby declaring that we have the power to, establish totalitarian regulation of the entire economy, but we're only going to use that power for now against one person. Isn't there something troubling in the fact that only that one person has standing, according to the D.C. Circuit? I mean, it seems to me that the people that have tried to challenge the illegality of the law on the basis of the tailor, one thing is that the people who are challenging the tailoring rule are saying, look, if you couldn't do the tailoring rule and you had to impose this on everybody, you wouldn't be able to impose this regulation at all, obviously, because the result, as you point out, would be absurd. And EPA, and for EPA to come back with this tailoring rule and say that because of the absurdity of imposing this regulation on the whole economy, it's going to claim the power to do it, but only use it against a couple of select emitters that were its real targets potentially all along, seems to me that. I just don't understand why environmentalists and proponents of EPA aren't worried about the implications of this and how easily it could turn into a double-edged sword to be used against them. I mean, there's just the rank arbitrariness of this whole thing. I mean, you can get from one argument to another. I've read through all of these rulemakings, and it's the most insanely convoluted interpretation of a statute that nothing in law school prepared me for this. I mean, prepared me to follow it, I guess, but. I think
we get the gist of your question. Right. Sean, do you want to go first?
Sure. So the denial of rehearing was December 20th, and I don't want to be giving Jeff gratuitous help here, but I'm guessing he figured this out on his own. It's the cert petitions would be due 90 days from that, and then the court rules provide for the opposing parties to file a response, which is 30 days, often 60 days in big cases, and then there's a reply. So, and then the court would after that meet to confer on the petition. So, it obviously wouldn't be if they granted, it wouldn't be this term that the case is heard. It would be the next term. Fall or winter. On standing, I mean, first of all, I guess I should note, and this is one I thought Marlo's overview was, very, very well done and economical, describing a lot in few words. I would note that EPA had an alternative ground for the tailoring rule, which was the doctrine of administrative necessity, which I think a lot of the a lot of my colleagues think is the more sort of apt and better of these alternative theories, and that is just basically a statute is not administrable initially, and you try to do what you can and make reasonable choices about implementing it to the maximum extent you can, and then move toward. And that's what EPA is now doing is analyzing experience under the rule and assessing over time how it can move toward the statutory thresholds, and it's acknowledged that it may not be able to get all the way there. First of all, I'd say, standing is, it's certainly environmental groups have been on the harsh side of this as much as anyone. It sometimes has, our Article 3 doctrines sometimes have consequences that can look harsh, right? There's government action that that we all might agree is you know, improper, illegal, that no one can challenge because of standing. And, you know, so that's not unique to this situation. And, you know, the totalitarian regulation, I mean, I would be troubled if the government asserted totalitarian regulation over anything, and I assume that there would be, you know, ways to get at that, that the sort of mere assertion of that would encourage people to find a way to stop it. But
we hope,
you know, so. I think it is troubling. I think for environmentalists, you know, what was troubling was making even a temporary exception to, you know, statutory requirements. That is troubling. I think when environmentalists have done well in an era of, you know, where the courts haven't been that favorable to us, I think, compared to some other eras, it has been when we've been able to, you know, point to the hard edges of statutory language. And so that, I will acknowledge, is, you know, it is troubling and difficult.
I think
manufacturing a wholesale exemption to the statute is more troubling and more improper. So it's, I think EPA pretty clearly explained the difficulty here, and that there's no way that you can get around this without doing some violence to statutory language. And I think a sort of exemption from the program is a good deal more offensive to plain language than what EPA has done.
Jeff, would you like to respond to the questioner?
Sure. I'll just respond really with this observation, which is that it is true that there were, you know, alternative rationales given by EPA. One of them is administrative necessity. Let me put that off to the side for the second and talk about their third rationale, which they called the one step at a time doctrine, or what I like to refer to as the heretofore unknown in the annals of the of federal law, the one step at a time doctrine. You know, that's obviously not something that the D.C. Circuit latched onto, because it seems to be a doctrine that was manufactured here. There is a, you know, the Williamson-Lee optical line of cases, but it's not really something that applies in this administrative law context. So, you know, that was kind of a misfire by EPA. But on the administrative necessity doctrine, I think what that creates for EPA is a kind of, a path problem for them. So, you know, if that's something that they can use to uphold the tailoring rule, then it's something that just magnifies the importance of the case and its impact on the national economy. Because what that means is that the regulation, you know, at the current level, which is, again, you know, levels Congress didn't intend, so I'm not sure it can entirely get them out of the absurdity problem that they spotted themselves, but let's just say for the sake of argument it can, it still means that then you would have to regulate at the 250-ton level, which would mean regulating, you know, vast swaths of the national economy, and then you don't have the argument available to you anymore that this is a, you know, very modest set of regulations. So, you know, it seems to me that they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they use that rationale, you know, to avoid absurdity, then they're into the soup or into the fire of exactly, you know, what this does to the national economy, and the fact that they kind of cooked up a set of rationales to avoid looking at the costs and benefits of imposing these rules on stationary sources.
Okay, well, I'm informed that we have no more questions from the listening audience. So, as much as I would like this conversation to continue, I mean, I could ask another question or two. What does Dean have to say about that? Do you want to end the program here? It has been an hour.
Well, we're just about out of time. Why don't we give each of our experts just a quick minute or two to wrap up?
That's a great idea.
Thoughts.
Let's do that. Okay, since Jeff went first in the opening, Sean, why don't you go first in the closing?
Thanks, and thanks again for having me. This has been fun and interesting. I think My view is the panel in this case got it right, and the EPA's actions are at least a reasonable implementation of Clean Air Act language. And I guess at the bottom of all this is I regard this problem as extremely urgent. And so sort of lots of discussion about the difficulties of applying the statute and wouldn't it be better if we had, a different approach and so forth. I mean, I think EPA properly finally got around to looking at this, very grave air pollution problem and said, well, if we don't have a specialized regime, we've got to apply the law on the books to this problem as best we can. That's what I think EPA is doing. I think if you look at the climate science since the endangerment rule, it's only more compelling. The U.S. Global Change Program's draft national climate assessment is available now, and it documents severe impacts and including a lot of ongoing impacts throughout the country. So I look forward to continuing to follow and participate in these cases. And again, thank you all very much for having me.
Jeff?
Well, this is Jeff Clark, and thanks to Sean for agreeing to appear here on this teleforum, and to Marlo for moderating, and to the Federal Society for putting it all together. Just two closing observations. One is, I think, overall at the biggest macro level, taking a step back from this case, the folks who are challenging EPA here are really interested, I think, in seeing that what's vindicated is really kind of the democratic process. And if it is, an issue that is such a big issue for the world, for the country, it's really something that I think, at least I personally, would rather be ruled by, a democratic process and by our republic than essentially by, some very, one of the callers said convoluted rules that are kind of cooked up in the halls of EPA. And then, I spent a fair amount of time kind of calling out the dissents from denial of rehearing en banc by Judges Kavanaugh and Brown, which I think, are excellent, and I commend, listeners to read if you have not done. But I think another, judge on the D.C. Circuit is worth calling out, and that's Chief Judge Sentell, who was on the original panel voting to uphold EPA's rules and was, and did also vote to deny rehearing en banc. But he did separately concur, and he made very clear that this is a situation in which, these cases are exceptionally important. And I commend him for that, because that's really, I think, an important, act of candor. I've certainly seen judges who'd be much more defensive of positions that they had taken, and Judge Chief Judge Sentell did not alter his vote, but he did make very clear that he agreed with the en banc petitioners that these cases are exceptionally important. And especially in a case that can arise only in one circuit, which is the nature of this set of rulemakings, you can only have these cases be reviewed in the D.C. Circuit because they're Clean Air Act rulemakings of national scope and applicability. That's a pretty important factor in I think the future analysis of the court as to whether they're going to think about taking certiorari in this case. And so with that, I thank everybody for listening.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much. And it has been an honor to have moderated this discussion by the Federalist Society. And since I'm only the moderator, I'm not going to give a disquisition of my own, but I would encourage people who are interested to look at my rather lengthy and detailed paper that I wrote for Engage back in November of 2011, because I explain there, I think, in adequate detail why I think the Supreme Court misread the definition of air pollutant in the Clean Air Act, which was really the linchpin of the entire Massachusetts versus EPA decision. And I also dig pretty deep into the tailpipe rule, which I think the auto industry not only did not oppose but supported, because EPA had them by the short hairs by virtue of granting California a waiver to effectively regulate fuel economy at the state level, and which I also think is a breach of statutory authority. So anyway, I encourage people, if they're interested in my perspective, to look at that. And I want to thank the panelists again for their fine presentations, and Dean and the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate.
Well, this is Dean Reuter once again. My thanks to Marlo Lewis, of course, Jeff Clark, and Sean Donahue for participating in our call today. I invite our audience once again to join us for our next conference call on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the food industry and class actions against the food industry. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.